Every day's Casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday. Tuesday, Casual Tuesday. Wednesday, Casual Hump Day. Thursday, Casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 19th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Heather Parton from Salon.com, or you may know her as Digby, from the Uber blog, Hullabaloo. Also on the program today, Manhattan Assemblywoman Uline New will be talking to us about her candidacy for the 10th Congressional District of New York, or the new Congressional District, the 10th in New York. Primary day is August 23rd. That is two business days from today. It's Tuesday. It's next Tuesday. Also on the program today, federal judge orders the DOJ affidavit underlying the Mar-a-Lago warrant redacted and released. Also on the program today, Republicans increasingly seeing Ohio as a Senate firewall, as the Cook Report puts the control of the Senate into the toss-up category. Pennsylvania now in the Democratic slot. Colorado a little bit iffier for Democrats. Nevada still a tight race.
If J.D. Vance blows it for him, it's going to be very satisfying.
That's going to be extremely satisfying, ladies and gentlemen. All this and more, well, that's not true, on today's Majority Report. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. First off, Emma is still out. She's feeling a little bit better, but COVID really handed it to her.
Yeah, we did just see and talk to her, so she is okay. But
one more day of rest. Yeah. One more day of rest. And I should also just come clean right now. I am not wearing a soft-collared shirt. Why, you may ask? Well, I got thrown off. We are actually recording this Thursday evening, pre-recording. I am heading on vacation. And like I said, Emma is feeling a little under the weather. And Matt did not renew his subscription to the video game series that he wanted to play on the show tomorrow. So that's what's happening. And of course, I got confused and I didn't wear a soft collared shirt, but I am going on vacation. I will be back a week from Monday. By all accounts, Emma will be here on Monday. If not, we will figure something out. But in the meantime, we're going to talk to Digby today. And we're going to be talking to Uline New, who is running in this crowded field in the 10th district. And I'm going to mention this to her, but I'll mention this up front, too. I really wasn't sure what I was going to do in terms of who we were going to have on this program. There are three strong progressives running in this race. And Carlina Rivera, who's a councilwoman from Manhattan, Mondaire Jones, who is the current congressman from the 17th district. And from the beginning of this race, I basically was saying to myself, my mental note was, I'm going to support the progressive who is, by to the extent that I can measure it, in the lead. If there is a significant or, you know, even measurable lead. And we've had three polls now on this race. And Yulin has, you know, appears to be in the lead in the of the last one, tied amongst the progressives in the other two that were taken a couple of weeks ago. And the bottom line is Dan Goldman is running this district. CD10 should not be going to a more or less corporate Democrat. And so we need a genuine progressive here. And basically, it is about strategic voting. This is a very progressive district. The CD10, I am convinced, was probably the highest density of Air America listeners in the country, or at least some of the zip codes there in within the CD10. And you got three, I mean, really, actually, like four, you know, Elizabeth Holtzman, I think you could also arguably say is progressive. But those three are in the lead. It's actually Yulin New and then Rivera and then Jones. And there's some questions about that Emerson poll, the last one. The other two polls came from the Working Families Party and from Data for Progress that showed Yulin and Rivera, Carlina Rivera in the lead at that time, more or less neck and neck. So, you know, I just want a full disclosure on that. That's the way that I came up with, you know, how we were going to present, at least interview her. This is not necessarily an endorsement, but I believe that you should vote strategically in this situation. And I am a big fan, in particular, of Mondaire Jones. I've had the opportunity to talk to him before he was a congressman, interviewed him then, have spoken to him since. And that is so it's, you know, and we're. He in the lead, I would have absolutely no hesitation, supporting him. And again, these polls could be flawed. It's the only data points that we have. So I just want that all out in front. We're going to be talking to Digby in a moment. But first, I want to play this video. It is really powerful, and it articulates what we were saying on this program, anticipating going forward. And it is the idea that this was not explicit to people when, in the decades, frankly, that I have heard sort of like centrist pundits, and of course, you know, right wingers are, I think, are oblivious to this. But centrist pundits or opiners or whatever, or politicians, that this scenario was not explicitly clear to people is, I think, a real failure. This is a clip of a South Carolina lawmaker. The guy's name, he's a Republican, State Representative Neil Collins. They voted in South Carolina, I'm not exactly sure when, to have a fetal heartbeat bill. I think it was 6 weeks. Essentially, that's where they may have pegged it. So that exists today in South Carolina, or since the ruling by the Supreme Court. They are now considering another bill that will get rid of the no rape or incest exceptions. They will just allow, essentially, the life of the mother is in danger. Again, these are very vague things. Do not, and here is a perfect example of why when you hear about exceptions to these abortion bills, it is meaningless. Meaningless. Here he is in a committee talking about what he came to understand about that so-called exception for the life of the mother.
I'll move to my final comments then, Mr. Chairman. I voted for the Pain Capable Bill, the Fetal Heartbeat Bill, and Fetal Heartbeat has been for 6 weeks now. The second week that the Fetal Heartbeat Bill became law, a doctor called me out of Anderson. I live in Easley. A 19-year-old girl appeared at the ER. She was 15 weeks pregnant. Her water broke. And the fetus was unviable. The standard of care was to advise her that they could extract or she could go home. The attorneys told the doctors that because of the fetal heartbeat, Bill, because that 15-week-old had a heartbeat, the doctors could not extract. So their only choices were to admit the 19-year-old until that fetal heartbeat stopped. I asked, how long does it take to stop? She said, seconds, minutes, hours, maybe days, or discharge. They discharged that 19-year-old. The doctor told me at that point, there's a 50% chance. Well, first, she's going to pass this fetus in the toilet. She's going to have to deal with that on her own. There's a 50% chance, greater than 50% chance, that she's going to lose her uterus. There's a 10% chance that she will develop sepsis and herself die. That weighs on me. I voted for that bill. These are affecting people, and we're having a meeting about this. It took that whole week. I did not sleep. I followed up with the doctor a week later. She had heard nothing, did not know about the 19-year-old. Thank God I followed up 2 weeks later. She did return to the ER. They did extract the now non-beating fetus. What we do matters.
Thank you, Representative Collins. Oh,
1 second, Mr. Chairman. I'm almost finished. Out of respect for the process, I'm not voting today. But I want it to be clear that myself and many others are not in a position to vote for this bill without significant changes to the bill. And
as Representative Newton said, if we pass this out as favorable, you'll have an opportunity on the House floor.
There you have it. And I don't know what changes they can, I don't know what changes they can make to a bill that doesn't allow for exceptions for rape or incest, or frankly, there's nothing you can do about this. 6 weeks, you have that story. Within 2 weeks, you have that story. And that's just because he heard about it. You don't know how many other ones there were of that. You don't know how many other ones you'll hear like, well, couldn't get a rape conviction. The rape conviction didn't come in.
Also, you have to have a Republican that's willing to like hear it and feel moved enough by it to voice it.
Yep. Yep. Maybe doesn't want to have a future in politics. The whole notion of exceptions on abortion is a complete lie. And it's a lie that maybe some of these lawmakers don't really fully appreciate or understand. We heard that woman testify, I think it was in front of Congress, saying, well, it's not an abortion if it's one of the exceptions. What? No, this is, I can appreciate that people have some religious values, but the fact of the matter is that there has to be a choice. There has to be a choice. A fetus or the autonomy of a person. Both are alive. One is a person. And this is, you know, there's only one way that this is going to change, and that is, and I don't think it's going to happen in this election, but you need the Democrats to have enough votes to lock in the right to an abortion in this country. And should they have done this before? Obviously, yes. It's obvious now. This wasn't something that, you know, We didn't take any phone calls on this program a year ago where people are saying, like, Democrats, if they ever get into office. And I can tell you, I was, you know, doing this in 2009. Did not hear many people say this. I think Obama may have said it actually in the run up to the election. But then all of a sudden you had the financial crisis and that took the air out of everything. All right. We're going to take before we get to Heather Parton. Just a reminder, today's program is sponsored by SunsetLakeCBD.com. SunsetLakeCBD.com. If you use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off all of their products. I am going on vacation this week with the children. I mean, my daughter's barely a child anymore. I am going to be... continuing my use of the tincture helps me go to sleep. And I suspect when I want to chill out at the beach and not hear people say, I want to go or I'm hungry or whatever it is, I might take a little tincture at that time as well. But there's gummies, there's kief, there's pre-rolls, there's bud, there's... coffee, there is fudge, there's gummies with melatonin, which my sister swears by. Mad at me for eating them all. She tried to steal them from me. All due respect to my sister. You got to check it out. They're a great company, mostly employee owned. They have great business practices. More importantly, or most importantly to me too, they are a movement partner. They have donated tens of thousands of dollars to things like strike funds, to Innocence Project, to give directly to food pantries. They practice regenerative farming. They use integrated pest management, so no pesticides, organic fertilizer. And all of their products, you can find third-party analysis, really breaks down every single thing that is in that CBD. Very important, regardless of where you get your CBD, to insist upon a third-party analysis of it. Check it out, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Use the coupon code LEFTISBEST. You will get 20% off of everything. 20% off of everything, SunsetLakeCBD.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Heather Parton or Digby. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. It is, well, as far as you folks are concerned, it's Casual Friday. I, unfortunately, am not wearing my soft-collared shirt, but Matt is getting real casual about intro songs. Nevertheless, we have... That's all right. Do you do it? Ladies and gentlemen, Heather Parton, or you may know her as Digby. Oh, he doesn't have it. All right.
Oh, well, whatever.
Hi, Heather. How are you?
Hi. Great to see you. We're being casual.
Yeah, great, we're being very casual. Too. All right. Well, listen. So let's start with this. It has been, in some respects, overshadowed by the search of the Trump Mar-a-Lago papers. But this week, the and frankly, Lynn Cheney or Liz Cheney, I can't even remember now. I'm sorry, I've forgotten. She's lost her her primary in Wyoming. We'll get to both those stories. But let's talk a little bit about the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. I don't think it's going to reduce inflation particularly, but I also think that it may get credit for reducing inflation, because I think we're starting to see the beginning of inflation dropping down. But the big things are its investments in fighting climate change. It's the cap on prescription drugs for Medicare, the negotiations of Medicare. Those things are somewhat delayed in the future. And we had David Dayan on last week to talk about maybe that they're, you know, from a political standpoint, too delayed. But and then they fixed the subsidies, at least for the ACA, which goes into effect immediately and will carry through 2024 past the election there. So that was done well. But overall, give me your sense of, and then, of course, the downside being there are opening up federal leases and tying some of the expenditures on renewable energy to offering those leases. It's unclear how much those leases will actually contribute in terms of emissions, but they are, of course, also end up, as most things, energy projects end up particularly impacting folks of marginal political power in our country. And then there's the Manchin side deal, which it appears that progressives are at least gearing up to maybe shoot down. So give me your sense, with all that said, of where this stands. I mean, this is the end of a long process, and it really, I don't know. I just remember one of those cartoons where, you know, the shirt goes in and they wash it and it comes out and it's tiny, tiny, tiny little thing.
Well, you know, I think there's the cliche about the sausage making has never been illustrated more, you know, perfectly than it was with these negotiations over the past 2 years or year and a half. Watching this unfold was intensely frustrating, and watching how they did it was it's just a sign of just how incredibly, I don't even want to say dysfunctional, because I just think this is written into the system, that particularly the Senate has this tremendous amount of power, and which actually ends up giving, in this case, all the power basically to two senators, one from Arizona and one from West Virginia. There's something that just makes no sense about that. It really doesn't. And we watched all that unfold. So my general sense about it, though, is one of relief, to tell you the truth, because, I mean, at least they got something. And I'm relying on the climate gurus that I follow to say that, you know, they're not unhappy. I mean, they're not thrilled. It's not everything they wanted, but they feel like this is a major step. And they are happy that it got done. So, you know, I guess I have to feel like that's good enough for me. I mean, I am happy also about the pharma stuff. I mean, the idea that this has been out there for many years. I mean, I think going back to the 90s, they've been talking about this. And the idea that this government could not negotiate with this huge, you know, government programs that they have, the VA and Medicare and Medicaid, that they couldn't, you know, find any way to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies, and that Americans were paying vast sums of money for pharmaceuticals all these years. I mean, it's been, you know, absurd that this was happening. So I give credit where credit is due. Those two things, I think, you know, are pretty big deals, and I'm happy to see that happen. But again, you know, like I said, the idea that it takes this kind of effort, and granted, in this case, this is a very, you know, it's a very, very thin majority in both houses, you know, virtually just one vote. It's kind of amazing that they got this done. So I'm willing to give them credit. I know you and I, back at the beginning, when we first started talking about Build Back Better and the big infrastructure bill and the whole package that was put forth, we were very excited about the scope of it. And people were talking about it being like the New Deal, you know, equivalent to that. And clearly that did not happen. But, you know, under the circumstances, it's not half bad. And I'm glad to see at least that the Democrats are doing, you know, at least something in this situation, these difficult political waters. They are at least showing, as compared to the Republicans anyway, that they can actually get a few things done. So, you know, thumbs up. And, you know, hopefully maybe the Democrats can put a few more senators in November if we're lucky, and maybe they can do better next time. Of course, we'll have to see what happens with the House if that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cap on medication, out-of-pocket medication costs for Medicare is actually, like, you know, I think it's hard for people. I think it's just hard for people who are, you know, not seniors themselves to appreciate the implications of that. And, you know, again, it's going to be 3 or 4 years before we really start to see the implications of Medicare being able to negotiate for drug prices, because as Medicare negotiates drug prices, it becomes really more difficult for pharmaceutical companies to be charging such disparate differences. Right. And very often, as Medicare sets certain prices, that becomes a benchmark that insurance companies require for non-Medicare patients, right? I mean, this is going to be a pretty transparent process. And so it's going to take a couple of years before we get there. We didn't have insulin within the context of outside of Medicare again. But supposedly there is some sense that this is going to be a bipartisan bill. Maybe I find that hard to believe, but who knows? Let's just talk about this. I mean, you know, and we went through pretty granularly over the past week between David Dayan and Leah. I can't remember her name right now, but we went through these bills, you know, with some granularity. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk a little bit about the political implications, because this is coming. There's a, you know, 6 months ago, I think if we had spoken, well, we did, but if we had spoken about this, we would have said Congress definitely, House definitely lost come November, and Senate probably lost.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, in my opinion, I think there's a good chance that the Democrats hold on to the Senate. I mean, the Cook Report today just called it, yesterday called it a toss-up. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit better than that. I mean, I was on Twitter, and our own John from San Antonio was talking about this Signal, I guess, for the John Locke Foundation poll, where you have Beasley and Budd basically tied.
Amazing.
And this is North Carolina.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're watching what's happening in Pennsylvania. I think, like, I think it's going to sink Mastriano's campaign. I think Dr. Oz is doing so bad. I think the Democrats are going to pull out the governorship there, maybe. And, you know, we're seeing this. This is starting mm-hmm. to happen around the country. Yesterday, the Republicans, you know, made a commitment to pour a ton of money into Ohio, because I think they're a little bit worried about J.D. Vance. And these are pickup opportunities for Democrats. Yeah. These are not, you know, defensive plays. Nevada is going to be tough. Colorado is going to be a little bit tricky. And Arizona is going to be tough. And New Hampshire is going to be a little bit tricky. But we'll
see. Wisconsin,
yeah. You know, there's an opportunity there. I mean, I'm starting to hear Florida, maybe, although I find that very hard to believe because of Florida Democrats. But what does the passage of this actually do on a political level? And just give me a sense of how you think it works, if it works at all.
I wish I felt like this would be just the biggest game changer in the world, right? That everybody would look to, you know, in the morning newspaper or flip to their on their phones and take a look and go, wow, the Democrats are really delivering for the American people, and I'm going to vote for them because I think that's terrific. I don't think that's the way it works anymore, if it ever did. I mean, not to say in any way that they shouldn't do it, because obviously the Democrats, every chance they get, have to do whatever they can, right, to deliver on their promises. And in the long run, it does make a difference, right? I mean, I think it may make a difference for the party somewhere down the road when all these things come to pass and they can take credit for it. And you've got a whole series of things from Obamacare on that you can say Democrats have done some really big things. And they have. But I just don't think it matters in this political environment as much as we think it will. I mean, sure, it gives them something to run on. And I think that's great. And I think it's much better to run on that than it is to run on, you know, if you get us in, we're going to run on these kitchen table issues and we'll do our, here's our 10-point plan for whatever, and run on that without having any accomplishments behind you. I think that's just really kind of lame. And I don't think people really believe it or care about it. Right now, we're running on some really other big issues that reply much more, I think, to the culture war. I think the abortion issue is huge. Yep. I think the democracy issue is huge. And I think that Donald Trump is huge. The specter of this, you know, the orange monster is hanging over this whole thing. And the party that he's created, or I shouldn't say that he's created, that he revealed. And that whole thing, which, plays into the other issues that I just mentioned, I think that's what the election's about. I think it's really, it's kind of a fundamental clash of worldviews and on some big important issues that are affecting people directly, particularly the abortion issue. Guns, too, I think that's, you know, much more at play than it was. So something happened this summer. You said this. You know, you and I were talking, and yep. We were saying, you know, it looks pretty dead in the water. I mean, it was looking like a blowout. They were calling it a red tsunami. Yep. And at best, they have a tiny red ripple that might get them over the edge, but it is not going to be a blowout. I mean, that seems pretty clear. And there's a reason for that. And I think the reason, and maybe the January 6th committee had something to do with it. Yep. But, you know, it's these big issues that are swirling around in our politics /culture, I think, that are driving politics right now. And as much as I'd like to believe that a great climate change bill or pharma, all those things are great, and maybe for some people they will make a big difference, but for the most part, I think it's a bigger kind of, you know, sort of national argument that we're having.
I think I largely agree. I think really what it does is it, and I don't know how you measure this, but it, I don't even know how the proper way to say this. It creates an absence of the critique that we would have heard from the Beltway media.
Yes, that the do-nothing Congress.
They can't do anything.
Right.
And particularly, you know, the Beltway media doesn't really seem to, you know, measure the efficacy or the relevance of a bill. It's really just a dollar figure, and the accomplishment of passing something is lauded for the sake of lauding. And so, as a political matter, I think what you just have is the absence of that line of critique, which, you know, I certainly feel like the political media, the mainstream political media, was sort of desperate to to cling to and wanted. Now, I mean, that's why, like, the absolute shock about Manchin, you know, turning around and doing that was, I think, you know, a fun story for them, and also like oh, we've got to, our assignment editors all have to change what we were planning to do at that point. And that absence, I think, is key, because it leaves, like you say, those issues, those other really looming issues, to play a bigger part in what happens in November. And I will say also this, that I think is important, that, you know, is probably a broader philosophical question. But I do think that, like, we're in an era where, and I said this during the Trump years too, but I don't know, you know, how close we are to a, you know, an existential, maybe that's too big of a word, fascist threat in this country, but we are certainly headed in a direction. Like, you would need to go through this juncture that we're going through to get there. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have to change course. You wouldn't have to reverse where we are. Like, we're on a trajectory. I don't know that we will reach that point, but we're on a trajectory there. And one of the things that leads to that, you know, this is one of the lessons from Weimar. I was actually listening to the Three Arrows podcast, and they were making this point that the sense that nothing can be done with our government, a frustration that there is just absolute, logjam, creates the type of cynicism and that, you know, is like fertilizer for those things. And so as, you know, as insufficient as it is, every time our government does something, it at least staves off a little bit of that cynicism and sense that nothing can happen with the type of government we have. I mean, I think to a certain extent that was at least some of the wind under Trump's sails in 2016, right? It was just like a broad frustration at government, and you know, you heard people going like, "Well, I don't really care," but you know, he's good. Maybe he'll tear it up and something good will come out of it. I mean, that's not the way it works, but you know, people made that argument, I think, in 2016. And again, I would also argue that it would also be a good thing for Biden to relieve student debt for that same reason. Like, yes. I think like doing something in and of itself that is meaningful, whether some people have some issues of it with it or not, is actually a very healthy thing for a democracy, to maintain a democracy. But so I think there's that benefit too, where you pass this legislation and there's at least the sense that people have like, okay, something's happening. But I think you're right. I think the two big issues are abortion and some of the January 6th stuff, I think, is really, you know, been revelatory for, you know, some measure of Republican voters. And it's really just a question of turnout. But let me cite John from San Antonio again. He said that the last objective poll in North Carolina was pre-Dobbs. That is the ruling that the Supreme Court made that overturned Roe v. Wade. And Beasley had a 4-point lead. Beasley had a 4-point lead, I guess. And now I guess it's tied. So I don't know if it works there or not. I don't know. Maybe he misspoke there, but that doesn't. But it is, you know,
I had heard that it was the opposite, that she has been. It would be very close. Dobbs, she had a 4-point lead.
Yes,
that
I think
had
that's
been mine. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so I think, and the more we're starting to hear these abortion stories, I mean, we just played a clip from a South Carolina state lawmaker.
I saw that.
Yeah. And it's really, I mean, these stories, I think, are going to become more prominent over the next couple of months, too, because, of course, not just because I think, you know, people are going to be focused on these things. And there's, you know, when folks give money to these PACs or whatever it is, this is what they do. They find these stories and they make them known to people and use them to motivate folks to vote. I mean, it's really going to come down to turnout.
Yeah. Yeah. And from what we can see so far, as the primaries are unfolding, I mean, there's some strange things happening. Now, you know, we all knew that Liz Cheney was going to lose her race. Yep. I mean, that was, and in fact, it's kind of sickening to see so much press being devoted to a race that we knew she was going to lose, but that's the way it is. I'm much more interested in what happened up in Alaska. Up in Alaska, you had this ranked choice voting for the first time. And Sarah Palin is running up there, one of the most famous Republicans in the country, and homegirl up there running for Congress for Don Young's seat. And she did not get as many votes as a woman by the name of Mary Peralta. Now, I come from Alaska. I went to high school up there, and I still know tons of people up there. And there's one reason why that happened. It's abortion. Alaska has abortion written into their constitution, and it has a longstanding, yes, it's very conservative now, very big red state, and, you know, a lot of, you know, Palin, Trump kind of love. But there's also this longstanding libertarian independent streak in Alaska. They consider themselves to be kind of unique and a little different, and they are. And this abortion issue did not play there It is not good for the Republican Party up there. And you have Murkowski, who is pro-choice, and you had this woman, Mary Peralta, and I would not be surprised if she pulls it off. That is because of that issue. It could be other issues, too. She has other things that are, you know, more localized kind of things. But really, it's kind of unexpected. And you know how Palin is. I mean, she's far right on that issue. And so was the other Republican that's running, Nick Begich. But that's another sign. I mean, what we saw happen in Kansas, I mean, there's an undercurrent here on this one that this is just really went too far, I think. And it's such a perfect illustration of that trajectory that you're talking about, that, you know, we're kind of crossing into a new, era here of Republican, you know, conservative, I wouldn't even call it conservative, radical politics. Radical right politics. And that illustrates it perfectly. They actually did it. You know, it's one thing, they've been saying it for a long time. They wanted to do it and they've been campaigning on it and whatever. But that complacency is gone now. And when you hear stories like this guy down in South Carolina crying basically over the ramifications of what he himself voted for, of one 19-year-old girl there. Imagine that, you know, I mean, there's millions and millions of people who are going to be in positions like that. And I think it's powerful, powerful stuff. And it's a battle that we have to have, right? I mean, you can't just chalk it up to politics. This is real people's lives being affected on a daily basis right now in front of us. It's not some abstract thing. So I think it's a big deal. And, you know, you combine that with all the rest of this stuff. That's one reason why Trump's making such a big deal out of his Mar-a-Lago, you know, whatever, the raid. You know, it's purely to try and gin his people up in light of all this other stuff that's going on that's really looking pretty bad for him and his side and his endorsees who are not doing very well.
Well, it's interesting the point you made, too, about the libertarian streak in really we're talking like civil libertarian in that respect in Alaska. Because if you look at the ads that made the big splash in Kansas, they are all from that angle, which is, you know, big government getting in between you and your doctor, which is what it is. I mean, it is, you know, when we talk about government overreach, this is what we're talking about here, right? Because, you know, somehow Republicans want to make a distinction between, well, it's wrong for the federal government to, to force us to have public schools for everybody. But the state government, well, they can mandate that forced pregnancies. And that seems to be a, you know, sort of the angle. And I think if you look at like Democratic candidates who are running in places, I think like Ryan is doing this a little bit in Ohio, and you look at and Mark Kelly in Arizona, that's what they're talking about. When they talk about abortion, they're talking about, do you want state government, they just call it government, interfering and with your relationship with your doctor. That's really what that's coming down. And we'll see. I mean, and I think that message is going to get honed, too, particularly following Kansas. One would hope the slightest bit of competency, they'd be looking at those ads and saying, OK, this is the way that we run in this, you know, reddish, purplish state on this question. Let's move to this thing about Mar-a-Lago. I read something today on Thursday in Business Insider where they're speculating who it was that was the leak, and aides are now, and again, who knows? I mean, if I was an aide and I was the one who leaked it, I would certainly blame it on Jared Kushner. but the FBI seemed to know exactly where to look in a safe and in a leather like box for these documents. Now, it also suggests that Donald Trump knew what he had, right? It's not like, oh, gosh, we put the 30 boxes. They didn't fit in the wine cellar. And so we took the other 12, we put it in the broom closet, and we forgot about it, and we didn't give it back. Like, I mean, and we don't know why he had these things. We don't know exactly what they were. We may find out More because the judge ordered the release and redaction of the underlying affidavit. So presumably the names will be redacted, but it'll be unclear how much this compromises the investigation going forward. We'll see. But we may learn a thing or two about what the motivation was here. How much is this like motivating people to come out and vote? I mean, I guess it is, right? Because this is like, you know, you've got everybody, all these, you know, all these Republicans saying like, this is war, this is unprecedented, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder how much it is going to motivate people to vote in the midterms as much as it does just sort of like raise Trump's profile.
Well, I'm certainly going to raise Trump's profile. And that has, you know, there's two sides to that coin. Because the more they raise Trump's profile, that also motivates Democrats to come out. I mean, that's one reason why the Republicans wanted him, you know, hey, you know, ixnay on the awking day. You know, they didn't want him right out there because he was, you know, he puts himself on the ballot, whether we like it or not. They wanted it to all be about sleepy Joe Biden. You know, they didn't want to have Trump out there at the top of the news. On the other hand, apparently, they've collected a lot of money over the past few days after this, you know, quote, raid happened. And so it is motivating that. But I find it hard to believe it's going to motivate voters any more than they were already motivated. Right. I mean, that group of Trump, you know, cult members, they were couldn't wait. They were crawling to get to the ballot box. They want to vote. They want to vote for guys, people like Blake Masters and people like, you know, J.D. Vance and Dr. Oz and all these Donald Trump people. But that's not a majority, even necessarily, of the Republican Party in some places. And the majority that exists in a place like Arizona, for instance, this Blake Masters, who is, you know, an ultimate, you know, what do they call them? Ultra MAGAs. He's an ultra MAGA, and you know he's not doing well in the polls. The general electorate there is not liking what they're seeing. They like Mark Kelly better. So I don't know how this really goes. And my gut feeling is, and I've been a little bit confused by this, to be honest with you, why Trump is pushing this thing as being the greatest thing, and the press went along with it too. The first thing they did, a friend of mine was listening to NPR. And the day that the story broke, and was shocked because the first thing that came out was Donald Trump's response to it, you know, as if that was the most, you know, most important thing. Oh, my God, Donald Trump's upset, you know, like, you know, really? Oh, there's a shocker. So the press kind of went with that and how this is going to affect the election and all that. But I'm a little confused by it because I honestly don't see how that group is as motivated as I think they can get. Was there some thought that they were falling out of the you know the electorate for him, and did they think that suburban Republican women, for instance, are going to be so upset that the FBI searched his house that they're going to come out and vote for him, even though they weren't going to do it before? I just don't see that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I'm, you know, could be, but I just don't see it.
I agree with you. I'm unclear as to the impact it's going to have. And I certainly don't think that Trump's intention, or at least his primary intention, is to help the Republicans in 2022. I mean, I think Trump's primary intention, I mean, he is starting to feel the heat, right? Yeah. Like he's got, like we watched a clip of Donald Trump Jr. the other day talking about DeSantis on Stephen Crowder's show. Mm-hmm. But put aside DeSantis, Trump is testifying this week he's got to deal with his Manhattan investigation. His CFO basically copped a plea. It appears that he's not going to cooperate, but I'm not sure if I would be. I don't know how confident I would be if I was Trump that guy's not going to cooperate. Like, yeah, I know they're saying he's not going to cooperate, and maybe that's the case, but I'd be a little bit nervous about that. I'd be a little bit nervous about what's happening in Georgia. You know, they're pulling in Lindsey Graham. They're pulling in Giuliani. Giuliani is a subject of the investigation. Mm-hmm. If he's got to go, you know, like Giuliani doesn't strike me as the type of guy who's like, well, I could do 6 months. You know, like, I know that, like, I'll take the fall for Trump. Like, I don't, you know, I just don't get the sense that that's, you know, I think he's got to be worried. And I think, like, you know, this is, like he said, I think it was just a day or two ago, like, we got to bring the temperature down or bad things are going to happen, you know. And so I guess the real question is, does he feel the pressure enough that he feels like he has to declare his campaign over the next 2 months.
Well, I've always thought he was going to declare sooner rather than later. I never thought he was going to wait until after the midterms, largely because of what you just said. The heat has just been, you know, it's really been building on him. And he's got some real issues to deal with personally. And then, you know, he's got, I mean, he took the fifth, you know, took the fifth 400 times in New York, you know, last week. Yep. I mean, this is a person who is, you know, feeling really for the first time the full weight of, you know, state power kind of coming down on him. So I've always thought he would declare. He believes that that insulates him because, you know, and he's already using the argument. They're trying to stop me from running. They're trying to keep me from running. That's one of the big ones that they're using for fundraising on the Mar-a-Lago search. So yeah, but on the flip side, his you know, super PACs, whatever they're doing with the money, nobody knows, but they're collecting a lot of money right now on this basis. So it's hard to say whether or not he wants to kind of run out that string a little bit more and collect more of that money, which they can then use for other purposes, and then declare, in which case then all the rules change and he has to start, you know, he has to do it differently.
Right.
I believe that he wants to declare badly. For one thing, he's got to put DeSantis down. I mean, he has got to put him down quickly. And interestingly, the one thing that the Mar-a-Lago search did was it kind of put a little bit of a damper on all of that stuff with DeSantis. I read a story this morning that said that there were some people who were starting to get, you know, big donors together to put together a DeSantis run, and they decided to pull back, and probably at DeSantis's direction. And the reason is, you can see, he's suddenly come out defending Trump, and this is, you know, an affront to democracy and blah, blah, blah. Those guys have a little fear around that because that's their voters. DeSantis is running for office. And so there is some thought that maybe that cult, you know, the hardcore MAGAs, that might have an effect on some of those people. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think he wants to declare. I mean, he's pretty much declared, right? I mean, is anybody really thinking that he's not going to run? I mean, of course he's going to run.
And I just want to highlight the point you made, that the when you declare, your ability to fundraise and use the money for any purposes ends. Once you're an official candidate, you fall under the rubric of the federal, you know, as anemic as they are, the federal election rules. But, you know, this dynamic that you're pointing out about how DeSantis, you know, felt compelled to sort of like come to Trump's, you know, sort of aid, as it were, or at least be perceived as doing that, is so twisted. I mean, it honestly feels like a really bad sort of like relationship where, you know, your friends or your therapist would be like, look, I don't know if you can't see what's going on here, but that person is, you know, they are doing the sort of damsel in distress thing, and everybody needs to be seen to be rallying on the damsel's, you know, side, or they're going to be seen as being, you know, traitors to the realm, as it were. Right. And the last thing DeSantis wants to be seen as is taking advantage of the, you know, evil Merrick Garland's, you know, aggressive attacks on freedom, the unprecedented, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, that's a nutso dynamic.
No,
and
kidding.
I think it's, I feel like things are going to be a little bit clearer in this way, probably, you know, a month from today. It's, you know, mid-August. I think by this time in September, we're going to start to get a notion of whether he's going to jump in or not, because things are going to heat up once, like, I don't know. I feel like all the lawyers and the judges probably go on vacation for the next 2 weeks, and then they come back after Labor Day.
Right.
And he may feel more pressure then. All right. Let's talk about, we just have a couple minutes here, but let's talk about this, about Liz Cheney.
Yeah.
Is it Liz Cheney or Liz Cheney?
Liz.
You know, like I,
whatever.
I have some type of block. I honestly do. Like I literally have been sitting, like, you know, writing headlines for the past like week, talking about her and reading Liz and writing Lynn. And I think it's just because I find the whole Cheney family, with all due respect to Mary, odious. And and I remind people every time I bring this up about Liz Cheney. 2019, she's out there talking about Democrats actively pursuing laws that will allow them to kill babies after they're born.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, that's just garden variety lunatic Republicanism. Mm-hmm. She threw her she came out against marriage equality because it was, you know, in her political best interest to do so, despite the fact that her sister was partnered at that time with a woman. She, you know, was intimately involved in a lot of her father's political machinations. And this guy, as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, really, if there was any justice in the world, would go down as one of history's, in the, at least in the latter half. Let's not make it compete with the first half of the 20th century. But in the latter half of the 20th century, is there another person who is more singularly responsible for the deaths of more people, innocent people? I don't know. It's hard for me to pick one. Maybe, you know, maybe Kissinger, but I don't know. Even if Kissinger, probably Kissinger, but it's a tough. You're in the top three. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. Dick Cheney isn't to, you know, carry on his tradition, but be that as it may, she's been, I think, effective in mm-hmm. the role that she's done. I think she would have to do that from here to eternity to atone, but maybe she will. What do you think? That I mean, first off, like, it is unbelievable how desperate the corporate media is to latch on to some semblance of like the slightest bit of like socially redeemable quality in a person who is a Republican. It is fascinating.
Well, I mean, they're desperate because they are still under, you know, living under that same old rule that they have a liberal bias. And so they're looking desperate. I mean, things are so bad on the right now that they're desperately reaching out for anybody who sounds even halfway normal so they can prove that they're not, you know, that they're not biased and that, you know, they aren't the liberal media. And when it comes to Cheney, I mean, I don't understand the need to just deify her. I really don't. She's doing the bottom line thing that anyone might have expected any mainstream Republican to have done up until, I mean, I would have said up until maybe 10 years ago that I would expect most, you know, mainstream Republicans. I'm not talking about there were always fringers. There's always people out there. But, you know, mainstream establishment Republican leader would look at someone like Donald Trump and observe what he did, and they would reject him. And they would go out there and say, no, this is not, you know, we're not doing that. That's
to be
not
fair,
gonna happen.
McConnell and McCarthy did it for 36
for 5
hours.
Minutes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, and but I would have expected that at some point they would have gathered around the leadership and they would have said, look, we can't have this. I mean, no, come on. We're not doing this. They just stormed the Capitol and tried to kill Mike Pence. So, you know, it's really, that's it. We're done. And we're going to impeach him so that he can't ever run for president again. That was the bottom, you know, that was just the very least, the lowest bar you could have expected anybody with any kind of a conscience to do. And they couldn't bring themselves to do it. So she's not doing anything that I would suggest in any normal context was that unusual. In this context, it's very unusual, obviously. So I give her credit for it. You know, it's not easy. She gave up her, but it's a congressional seat. I mean, really, whatever. So, you know, she gives up her congressional seat. And yes, she probably had a road to the leadership. But I never got the sense that Cheney was that well liked anyway. So I don't really think she was going to the top. And, you know, so it's fine. I mean, it's fine to give her due. She's done some, and she's a, for all the reasons that you suggest, because she is the daughter of a war criminal. She was involved in that war. She worked at the State Department under Colin Powell. I mean, she was involved in all that stuff herself. And as you say, as recently as 2019, I just pulled up a post yesterday. I was looking for something on my blog and I called her the most dangerous woman in America in 2019. So, you know, I mean, she was not somebody that you know, I think was, you know, on the right path. But for whatever reason, she decided to do this. And I think some of it's cynical political positioning as well. I think she sees a path for herself in the future. I've always thought that. Great. Good for her. She makes a perfect person in many ways to be a spokesperson, because she's who she is. She can be the spokesperson that is out there that, what do they call it? Trusted voices, trusted
interlocutor, yes.
Whatever. So she can be that person. And I would suspect that for a few Republicans, that's meaningful. You know, people who still they can't quite leave the party. Maybe they've gone independent, or they're just sort of not really feeling at home in either place. And they look at Liz and do that. So that brings us to the idea of her running for president. And normally, I would think, great, she can siphon off those Republicans from Donald Trump, and won't that be great? Because then because it's very close, and it'll probably do something. But you know, I don't trust these Democrats. I mean, I have to say, it worries me to death the idea that a bunch of Democrats would, after watching her being deified on the media, going, "Well, she's a brave person, and she stands up for what she believes in, and she believes in the Constitution and democracy." And you know what? I'm just going to vote for her. And by the way, you know, she'll be the first woman president. I mean, I could just see all that happening in some Democrats' minds. So I come to the conclusion finally that no, you know, it's not a good idea. You know, if she runs in the Republican primary and can do some damage to Trump, that's fine. But this woman is not without ego. And I have a feeling that if she comes out with even the slightest bit of support out of a Republican primary, that she'll run third party. She'll join that stupid forward party or whatever. Yep. You know, she'll do something like that. And so I'm against it, because I just don't trust. There are too many Democrats who are just, you know, wishy-washy and ready to, you know, throw themselves onto the pyre, you know. So I'm not, I say no, don't run, Liz, don't run.
I couldn't agree more with you. And as far as the decision that she made, I think it's like the bottom line is, you know, we mentioned McCarthy and McConnell came out for 36 hours. I think she came out hard in that window. And I think she just assumed like, oh, this is going to come back around and I'm going to be the leader of it. And I'm going to look good for paving the way. And then at one point, you're just too far out on the plank and you're like, I got to jump because I can't go back that way. And, you know, I don't have that ability to do that. And so I'm going to go forward. And then there was one play for her to make, which is go all in and, you know, hope that there's, you know, some pathway in the future that is there. And I wouldn't be surprised if she tries to force one. And I agree with you. I don't think it's a good idea. And it's really important, I think, that people maintain in the front of their minds, we can be happy with her asking tough questions and being articulate on the January 6th committee, and then want to hear nothing more from her for the rest of her days. Right. Go take the corporate job, wherever it is you're going to take it. Sit on the boards, you know, build on your millions. Well, Digby, I can't tell you how much I appreciate talking to you about this. So glad we were able to catch up. And I will see you soon. Okay. I am headed on vacation. And so that's that.
We'll reconnect after that. Have a great vacation,
look forward
Sam.
To it.
Thanks.
Thank you. Heather Parton, ladies and gentlemen. Check her out at the blog Digby's Blog or at Salon.com, where she writes a twice-weekly column. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be interviewing Yulin Niu. She is running for Congress in New York's new 10th Congressional District. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Want to welcome to the program Yulin Niu. She is a Manhattan Assemblywoman and a candidate in the upcoming primary. It is Tuesday, August 23rd. It is only a couple of business days away for the Congress. She is running for the new Congressional District, the 10th Congressional District. Yulin, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
So I should just say, up at the front of the program, I made this point. I'll make it again. When this race started, I think arguably Elizabeth Holtzman too, although I think that looking for sort of some new folks in Congress. But there were three candidates that I felt like if I was voting in this race, I would vote for any one of these three. But the one that I wanted to make sure did not win, particularly after de Blasio dropped out, was Goldman. I mean, he is a, you know, basically a corporate corporatist. This is a very progressive district. And, you know, I think the world of Mondaire Jones and had the opportunity to interview him in the past. I think he's done some good work in Congress. And Carolina Rivera, I think, is a great councilwoman. But for me, it is about making sure a progressive wins this seat and Goldman is stopped. And the polling suggests you're that person.
Yes, I think that I am. I believe that I'm the only viable candidate in the race that's not taking real estate or corporate money. This presents the sharpest possible contrast with Dan Goldman, who is literally attempting to use his generational wealth and cash with real estate dollars, corporate interests, including Trump's super donors, to buy this election. And, you know, he's very, very deeply self-funded. This community needs a leader who understands, obviously, the diverse needs of this district, not someone who literally came in from the Hamptons to run for Congress as a hobby. And it is concerning that you know, Dan struggles actually to answer basic questions about the district. And since I've represented this district for the last 6 years in the state assembly, you know, 100% of my assembly district is actually inside of the new New York 10. And so I am the proud pro-abortion rights, pro-immigrant, pro-healthcare values of this district. And so I think that it's very, very reflective of our district. And I think that, you know, we don't need somebody who's inconsistent on abortion, talked glowingly about working with ICE, and opposes Medicare for all.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I mean, in my mind, this is a hands on, all hands on deck a moment, because it is really important in congressional districts where we have the opportunity. I mean, let's face it, like I was to add up in the polling, and again, you know, the polls, you know, are polls, but right, they're our only data point. We would add up, you know, the progressive vote in this thing, it would be a landslide. I mean, five times over. And, but because of the nature of this, and frankly, because of Sean Maloney, bigfooting Mondaire Jones, and frankly, that's another topic for another day. but this is where we're at. And you mentioned a couple of things: real estate money, and you mentioned abortion. I want to talk about. Let's start with abortion. The New York Times ended up endorsing Goldman, It was fascinating to see just how weak he is on abortion for someone. I mean, really for any New York congressperson, but particularly for this seat. And this seems to be like the key issue in 2022. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's the key issue in 2024. And we're going to need, it seems to me, in the House, representatives across the board who are as invested in abortion rights as possible.
Yes. Even Kansas gets it more than him.
Yeah.
I mean, our fundamental right to bodily autonomy is literally under attack. And this is a life or death issue. And we are already seeing the devastating impact of abortion bans in communities across this country. We watched as a woman literally bled out and then died. And so we need to pass Women's Health Protection Act on the federal level. New York actually is already stepping up to the plate. We ensured that we can serve as a haven for people in need of abortion care. And, you know, we want to make sure that we are unapologetically champions of abortion rights in Congress. And I think that, you know, right now, we need to understand how we got to this point, right? The Republicans have spent decades engineering a judicial coup. And then they've gutted abortion rights, they've gutted gun safety, they've gutted climate policy, they've made clear that this is just the beginning. And we know that right now it's not going to be, and this is what enrages me the most, but we know that it's not going to be, you know, wealthy, white, privileged, cishet women who are going to be able to, you know, get the healthcare they need whenever they need it, wherever they need to go to get it, right? It's going to be the people of color. It's going to be low-income folks. It's going to be rural people who are literally going to not be able to reach healthcare fast enough, right? It's going to be people with disabilities that are going to be hurting the most, right? And so we have to talk about equity as well. And in New York State, we actually passed the Equal Rights Amendment also, and we have to make sure that we have equal access to abortion rights.
Earlier in the program today, we played a clip from a South Carolina lawmaker who had begun to sort of dawned on him after he got a call from a doctor on the implication of his vote on the 6-week, you know, the so-called heartbeat ban of abortion in South Carolina. And he heard this harrowing story of a 19-year-old woman who, you know, could have easily died because of that that ban. And so this is going to really, I think, move to the forefront. But let's talk about in terms of New York, which is really important. In New York politics, and particularly in New York City politics, that's real estate funding. And I was just reading that the so-called New York Progressive PAC is a PAC. Well, are you familiar with the New York Progressive PAC?
It just was basically made, I believe. Sorry about that. It was just basically made a couple of days ago, I believe.
Yes.
And made by the people who put together the Common Sense PAC.
And the Common Sense PAC, apparently it was a guy named Jeffrey Leb.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry.
No worries. It happens. It happens. We have far greater technical problems than that, I can assure you. But this guy, Jeffrey Leb, was this PAC, essentially, it's a different PAC, but, you know, just basically a different name. Is involved in a real estate developer PAC that targeted DSA city council candidates in the city. They are the same interests that have gone after a bunch of progressive and DSA folks. And this is the one person apparently they're really gunning for seems to be you.
Yes. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, and I think it's because they fear that I am not beholden to real estate dollars. So.
And like, but I mean, explain to people the, I mean, obviously you're in Congress, you're not, you know, you're not voting on necessarily, I guess, on, you know,
land use,
but it really makes a difference. I mean, we saw AOC was, you know, at least one of the big names in drawing a lot of attention to, you know, the big giveaway to Amazon and basically stop that in its tracks. I mean, is that what they're afraid of? They're afraid of a congresswoman who is going to draw attention to that type of like real estate abuse in the district?
Yes. And I think, you know, we've seen what Warren's been saying. We see what AOC has been saying. We've been seeing, you know, what Katie Porter's saying. We have to get big money out of politics, and we have to get corporate money out of politics, and we got to get real estate dollars out of politics. And in New York, it's particularly interesting because the real estate dollars have stopped bills before. They stopped bills that have been, you know, really important to New York, such as the Good Cause Eviction Bill on the state level by Julia Salazar. This bill would help to prevent some of these incredible rent increases that we're all experiencing right now in New York. And it would have been something that would have been very essential and crucial to so many folks on, you know, who are paying rent and on the ground right now. And I think that it's so important for us to recognize that, right? That there was a huge rent package that we were able to pass in 2019. I was a part of that effort, and it was historic in so many ways. And it really took away a lot of the power of the real estate industry. And how did we do that? It's because we actually had, you know, a lot of members who were not beholden to the real estate industry. We had a lot of members who were willing to run on that, right? And to make sure that, you know, we overturned the IDC, that we actually had a whole brand new Senate with a real Senate majority being Democrats, right? And Democrats voting with Democrats. That was a nice change, wasn't it? And so I think that, you know, it was really important for us to make those changes, to not be beholden to real estate interests. And this is one of the biggest reasons why, you know, we have to make sure that we are not taking campaign dollars that can influence the real estate industry and folks who need to have protections.
Let's talk a little bit about the climate change. There was obviously just a big bill that was signed this week. From all the conversations I've had with climate activists, net win, not the full sandwich, but at least it's a down payment, I guess. You are known apparently in Albany for pushing a Green New Deal spelled with N-I-O-U, your last name. Just give me your sense of, like, you know, what you think needs to happen. It's not inconceivable that Democrats could hold on to the House in the fall. It's not inconceivable. I don't know if it was likely, but it seems at least very possible that they're going to hold the Senate. So you're partly there, and if the right senators get elected, it's not inconceivable that the filibuster goes away. I mean, you know, this is like a perfect storm type of situation, but perfect storms happen.
Storms, right?
Right. Well, in that in the event that something like that happens, like what do you, based upon the work that you've done, like what do you perceive as like the sort of the most important things that we need to be doing in terms of fighting climate change?
Yeah, so I believe that, we have just exactly the things that you're talking about. We have to pass the Green New Deal. We have to make sure that we are actually looking at trying to further how we're going to actually hold polluters accountable. That's the one thing that's truly missing from this new package the Inflation Reduction Act actually brought us. I think that it is a step in the right direction in addressing the climate crisis, but the deal also included a lot of the critical investments in clean energy, manufacturing, environmental justice that we wanted, but it still leaves us a lot more room and more work to do in order to meet our climate goals. And I think that, we have to make sure that polluters pay. We have to stop these corporate loopholes. We have to make sure that we are continuing to look through things in an intersectional lens because, when I talk about environmental justice, we can't just talk about like environmentalism, right? We have to talk about environmental segregation and really what different communities are going through because of the environment. And I think that, we see that a lot within my district. You know, the climate crisis is not a theoretical thing for Lower Manhattan and Brooklyn along the waterfront, right? We've walked through those floodwaters. We've seen businesses destroyed by the cost of repairs. We've seen certain neighborhoods really suffer and then other ones, make it okay. I mean, even when you were looking at that shocking photo of Lower Manhattan after Hurricane Sandy, where it was all dark except for Goldman Sachs, it was literally like a shocking picture of what Lower Manhattan became right in that moment and what was happening to our neighborhoods. And I think that, our district is already seeing the benefits of certain legislation that we've passed on the state level that I helped to, usher through the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, what we call the CLCPA. We need to fund it more, but I think that we've already started to see some of the benefits, such as the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal in Sunset Park, right? This district can become, I think, a hub for tech innovation and be a leader in pushing for investments in climate resiliency. And I think that right now we are needing a Congress member who knows what the needs of the district are and then brings that to Congress and brings home the things that we need. One of the biggest things inside of the Green New Deal package that I love is the greening of public housing. So our Green New Deal package for public housing is something that I think is direly needed. We need to get those funds to help to build more public housing. And we also need to repeal the Faircloth Amendment, for example, to be able to have more housing, because the Faircloth Amendment is this arbitrary thing. And you probably have talked about this on this show, actually. It's the arbitrary thing that says that we cannot build more public housing past the 1991 levels of public housing units. And we have like changed in our population by so much since 1991, increased by so much, and yet we have not built more public housing. And our public housing in New York is the only real, truly affordable, deeply affordable, and permanently affordable housing that we have here. And I think that we need to make sure that we're building more and not less.
Yeah, you. I was just about to ask you about NYCHA, and yes. I don't know if people understand that that when we talk about public housing in this country, we are largely talking about New York. Yes. I mean, in terms of just like sheer numbers of units. And aside from that arbitrary, I mean, I don't, you know, what was the logic of pegging it on 91? Just that this is is this something that that needs to happen on a federal level, essentially, to free up these funds? And how much like NYCHA housing sits in the congressional 10th district, and how much of a deficit do you perceive there being?
Yes. So I actually, you know, because 100% of my district is inside of it, I know it so well. Like one third of my assembly district is actually public housing. People don't realize that here in Lower Manhattan, right, is one third of the district is actually, you know, public housing. So in the entire District 10, it's about one fourth of the district. So it's actually a lot of units, a lot of families, so many different housing complexes. And, you know, we need to fully fund public housing. Since 1991, the federal government has clearly divested from public housing. They've taken money and, you know, not put it into public housing. They have not put in new dollars for a while now. And so for decades, they've divested from public housing, dollars that should be coming into our states to take care of our public housing. And on the state level, I want to say that I'm very proud to have been the person to write the letter, to make sure that all of my colleagues who have public housing in their districts sign the letter. And we were able to fight for now over $1 billion in public housing capital dollars coming from the state. And, you know, every single time I go and ask for that state money, I am told it is federal responsibility to get, you know, dollars to our public housing. And I try to fight against it as much as I can to get those dollars to our community, because I'm always saying, you know, hey, these are residents of our state, these are residents of our communities, and we need to make sure that we take care of them. People cannot live with mold, with no hot water, no heat, you know, boilers that are decades old, you know, folks who, you know, have seen, you know, there are people who literally have to heat their house with their ovens open. Right. And it's dangerous. Like, people can literally hurt themselves that way. And I think it's very, very important that, you know, we are actually bringing those dollars. So Maxine Waters has an incredible housing package that she had put into Build Back Better. Obviously, we know Build Back Better was not brought back home to us. But inside of Build Back Better, there was a really, really good and comprehensive housing plan. And I think that we should be able to put this into another bill, perhaps, much like we did for the Inflation Reduction Act, right? We can put a different package together. But this housing package was really very good. It was fully funding our public housing with $70 billion. It was also making sure that we could have more funding into Section 8. An influx of dollars into Section 8 would be so helpful for the voucher programs that we have. And Section 8 is very varied. There's a lot of different kinds of affordable housing within Section 8. And then there's also homeownership programs. There's a couple of different programs for like kind of like new Mitchell-Lama kind of housing deals. And I think that it's really amazing to see package like that, and it's $370 billion, and I think that that's something that would help to revamp everything. And I think that what we need to do is repeal the Fair Clock Amendment, right, fix the past, then right now we need to fully fund, you know, our public housing, and then in the future we need to also make sure we pass the Green New Deal and then also get, you know, a funding stream from the savings of greening our public housing to make sure that those energy bills and the dollars saved from not having to pay those large energy bills will help us to be able to build more public housing.
Well, I want people in New York and outside of New York to just imagine, I'm not going to have them on Dan Goldman on the program. But I want people to imagine if he would have the depth of knowledge and the passion for that type of public housing program.
Well, he said it very adamantly that he was against the Green New Deal. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he has a clue, frankly, about public housing. I don't think it even dawns on him, frankly, that it exists or how important it is. And this is one of those situations where what happens in New York sets the tone for public housing across the country because of its very nature. So New York could be setting an example in terms of total neglect, or it could be setting an example of, you know, what we need to do in this country, particularly now with the rise in interest rates and the loss of housing that we had in 2008. And we're going to see it again now because of this. We're still underhoused in this country. Such an important issue. Yulene, what does it take now just to win in a shortened primary window, a completely new district? This is a sort of a almost like a one in at least a decade type of event, maybe one in I don't know how many decades, really, because of the nature of there was multiple different congressional districts. This district, half of it was in Staten Island 3 months ago for like 2 weeks, essentially. And so what does it take to win in this situation? You know, like what do you need from folks?
I mean, I think it takes a coalition of folks to, you know, get the vote out. It takes all of our volunteers on the ground. We have right now so many volunteers, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of volunteers are coming out for us. So it's really, really about making sure that people get the word out. You know, folks can find more information about my campaign at newfornewyork.com, NIOU for newyork.com. And I think that, you know, people can sign up to phone bank, people can sign up to text bank, and people can make sure that they are getting involved, because that's what it takes. And I'm betting on the people of this amazing district to be able to make sure that we can get this done.
Voter turnout is going to be key. This is the bottom line. That's why Goldman and his real estate buddies are spending literally millions upon millions of dollars in a 3 month race, essentially.
That's right.
Because it is really just going to be ultimately about voter turnout. August 23rd in New York City. People are thinking about going back to school, or they're, you know, I imagine Goldman's not going to go out to the Hamptons on that day, but it's unclear. We will put a link to your website at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube description. Thanks so much for joining us today, and good luck. You got 4 days to go, I guess.
Yes. And, you know, hopefully everybody can come and join our giant event that's happening with Jabari, with Shahana, and with Tiffany. So it'll be really, really fun. And I hope that folks will come out.
All right.
Thank you, Sam.
Yulene, really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Sam.
Folks, super important. If you are in New York and you're in the 10th Congressional District, I think you can still, as of today, maybe do some early voting. I think that goes until Sunday, if I'm not mistaken. But we will, maybe we can just look that up. But I just want to say this, too, that we didn't get to this about the endorsement from Trump of Goldman. And a lot of people are sort of like poo-pooing it as if he was, that it was tongue-in-cheek and this and that.
Well, that's the official Goldman line. I got an election. I just replied stop to, but he said, last week, Donald Trump attacked Dan Goldman, who led his impeachment. Now he's pretending to endorse Dan. True to form, Trump is trying to manipulate an election because he clearly fears Dan.
Yeah. The reality is this. New York politics are odd. Very odd. There is a substantial population within the 10th Congressional District, and really all around, like different places, pockets in Brooklyn. Actually, there's some up in, I think it's Greene County or Ulster County. But of Orthodox, some are Hasidic Jews. They register Democrat because they vote as a bloc and they can influence, primaries. But they are Trump voters. broad brush, but something like 80% of the Hasidic community voted for Trump. And, you know, there's also a modern, so-called modern Orthodox community. Guys like Kushner, for instance, don't necessarily live. I don't know if Kushner lives in this district, but and so when Trump does that, he is reinforcing that vote. I want to make that clear. The idea that, you know, they're poo-pooing the whole thing because it's just a joke and tongue in cheek. And why would he do this? No. He knows what he's doing. Go take a look at some of the people he pardoned. Like an extraordinary amount of modern Orthodox real estate interests. And so the New York politics are funny. The bottom line is you got to get out and vote. That's the first thing. And again, I think Carolina Rivera and Mondaire Jones are great candidates. I really feel strongly that Mondaire Jones, a great candidate. And I think both of them are going to have future in New York politics. But we have a very limited amount of information in terms of like assessing who can consolidate the progressive vote. Yulin is endorsed by the Working Families Party. And I don't know if the DSA has weighed in on this, but I imagine they did. They're supportive of Yulin as well. This is just she is just the best bet, and based on the polls. And you know, again, polling is polling, but we have a limited amount of information. And so, if you want to stop the real estate interests, if you want to have a genuine progressive, dare I say, leftist in this congressional seat. Again, one quarter of the district is public housing. NYCHA is, when we talk about public housing in this country, we talk about New York. We don't say it, but we're talking about New York. And as New York goes, so too will the rest of the country. And so very important race. And you want a progressive in there. She is a great one. And like I say, for my money, the best opportunity to coalesce that vote.
And the early voting goes to the 21st.
Okay, so that is Sunday. So check it out. Go vote. Very important. Very, 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 very important. And folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show, free of commercials, although you can always check our descriptions for any deals, et cetera, but you also get the fun half and you allow the show to survive and thrive. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We have no fun half today. I'm sorry. That was not the plan. But, you know, COVID wasn't the plan for, you know, this whole summer has been, frankly, I mean, I don't want to whine like a baby. And I'm going on vacation.
It's like we're all acting like we're back to normal, but it still doesn't feel normal.
No, I mean, you know, for 2 weeks, my ex was out of commission. And so, you know, the kids and then, you know, there's anxiety that exists. And then everybody in the office now, we're all in the club. So, you know, I still wear a mask when I go into... I walk through into this building and, folks, you can do on your own, but, so no fun half, but, by Monday, I'm hoping, knock on wood, we are at, full, strength more or less. And I will be back in a week or so. So, have a great weekend, Matt. What's happening in the Matt Lekian universe, which could be a little bit expanded next week. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, if Emma's out on Monday, I'll be in the driver's seat. But
whoa, you know, now people are conflicted.
So yeah, I am if you want another day off. But patreon.com/leftreckoning to get our conversation from this Sunday with Ben Burgess about debunking right-wing populism as the big lie it is.
All right, folks, have a great weekend. Don't forget, if you're in New York, go vote August 23rd, or you can early voting until this Sunday. Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know.